We are finally there, down to the end of what we plan to do. And truthfully, we're right here. So when you study and you look at apologetics, we have just scratched the surface. And I know every night I've said we're barely scratching that. And truthfully, we are. So my goal is to really encourage you to study on your own, to take this, and to look at it because you're the jury. And everything, you can take two sides, two different ways to interpret about everything. But with God, there's only one way to interpret it. And our goal is to interpret it the way God wants us to. And I tell people who might disagree with me about, did Jesus live? Who was he? Really, if I'm wrong and he didn't exist, he isn't God, what am I missing out on? Some cursing, evading taxes, smoking. But what if my position is correct and you are wrong, and there is a God? Jesus is the Son of God, the one that you need to listen to. You're going to miss out on a family here, but more importantly, you're going to miss out on eternity. And that's something that makes it worthwhile to really study and to dive into. So in preparation for the final that we're going to have tonight when you leave, I'm going to do a little review. So lesson one, I kind of went through and tried to put things in my mind from what is weakest to strongest. I think tonight is the strongest arguments. But we looked at the fact that I don't think the Bible is a science book or a history book. I think it's God's diary. But when it talks about history and geography and science, it might use the idioms of the day, but it's accurate. And I told you, don't be afraid to study. Don't be afraid to study science because it points to God. He is a creator. And then we actually looked at some quotes of prominent scientists who say that there is a God. They believe. They say, I studied science, and I was able to see God because of his creation. We talked about the fact that in studying, it's a good idea because it builds your faith. It answers questions. We looked at how to accept evidence. There's different ways that you can look at evidence, and you can judge what you're studying. We looked at common ground. We looked around the world and mainly at the Chinese language. But we could see footprints that God has left us through different cultures, through language, through history. We read the same stories, both in their history as well as in the Bible. And so if that is true, why is that? Was there a common source, or did these things evolve simultaneously around the world? We looked at the flood. And the fact that that's a common story through pretty much all people groups throughout the world. The world was destroyed. There was this great flood. So either there was a common beginning or they all stole it from each other. Next, we looked at the universe around us. And we truly do see that the heavens declare the glory of God. And when I look at space, that's exactly what I see. I can see the handiwork of God just like Psalms tells us. We had a verse that said, O Lord, how many are your works? In wisdom you made them all. The earth is full of your possessions. And then Monday night, we looked at the human body, and we were told that a man has evolved from lesser forms. Those lesser forms evolved. You go on back, it was just particles somehow magically came together. But I told you about how I don't think that's realistically possible. And there are a number of scientists who, when they calculate it, they will tell you it's statistically impossible. It couldn't have happened. But that's the dogma of the day. Scientists say, we don't know how, but that's how it happened. Last night, we looked at the least controversial. Did Jesus live? And the Bible references that we look at are confirmed in secular history. And we talked about, it's very extraordinary that you can get an outline of Jesus' life and his teachings just by looking at secular history and what people said about him. His enemies attest to the fact he lived, that he died, that his disciples thought he rose again. But that gets us to tonight. What did Jesus say? What did he talk about? Now, he asked his disciples, who do you say that I am? And if we ask people today, who is Jesus? Well, he's a good teacher. How many good teachers, after they win the teaching award, are taken out back and hung or shot? We don't kill our good teachers. We promote them. We want their well-being. We don't execute good teachers. In the Quran, they say he was a prophet and he performed miracles, but they don't say he was the Son of God. The Dalai Lama says he was a being who reached a high state of enlightenment. The Swami who brought us yoga, so when he moved to the U.S., that's where yoga comes from, is it's a Hindu teaching. But he says he was a great prophet. And probably my favorite is the atheist for Jesus. They don't believe in God, but they can't deny that Jesus lived and he affected history, so they have to say something about him. So they say he was an individual of tremendous compassion. What did Jesus say about himself? Well, he claimed a unique relationship with God. John 10:30 says, "My Father and I are one." In John 5:17 and 18, he says, "My Father has been working until now, and I have been working." The people around him knew he was claiming a different relationship with God than anybody else had ever had. And in John 5, it continues, "Therefore the Jews sought all the more to kill him, because he said God was his Father, making himself equal with God." So the people of the day knew what he was claiming. He claimed to forgive sins. Now, you know the story of the paralytic. He was dropped down. They broke apart the roof. They dropped the man down. They didn't bring him here to be healed of his sins. They wanted him to be healed physically. They wanted him to walk. And Jesus said to him, "Son, be of good cheer. Your sins are forgiven you." And how does that continue in Matthew 9? Well, they grumbled in their hearts. They said, "Who can forgive sin? Only God can do that." But Jesus tells them, "You can't see me forgive sins, but you can see me healing somebody. So that you will know that I can forgive sins, I'm going to heal him." And so what did he do? He said to the paralytic, "Arise, take up your bed and go to your house." And he arose and departed to his house, proving his point that he could heal the man as well as forgive sins. What else did Jesus claim? He claimed to be sinless. John 8:29, "My Father has not left me alone, for I always do those things that please him." John 18:23, Jesus said, answered him, "If I have spoken evil, bear witness of the evil." John 8:46, "Which of you convicts me of sin?" He says, "You've been around me. What have I done wrong? Can anyone point out an error I have ever done?" And they couldn't. The early apostles and the teachers, the early disciples, they all agreed that he hadn't sinned. The writer of Hebrews tells us in Hebrews 4:15, "For we have a high priest who is in all points tempted as we are, yet without sin." Now in Luke 18, what did Jesus say? He said, "For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and everyone who humbles himself will be exalted." To claim you are sinless, to claim you're perfect, to exalt yourself like that, that's a pretty high exaltation, unless it's accurate and true. So he's either sinless or he's a hypocrite, based on what he said. I'll give you a sneak peek at this one. What else did he claim? He claimed that his words would judge the world. John 5:25-27, he says, "He had also given him authority to execute judgment because he is the Son of Man." And in John 12:48, he says, "He who rejects me and does not receive my words has that which rejects him," or that which judges him. "The word which I have spoken will judge him in the last day." It's a pretty weighty claim for a mere man. What else did he talk about his words? He said he spoke the words of God. Matthew 24:35, he said, "Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will by no means pass away." John 14:24, "And the word which you hear is not mine, but the Father's who sent me." In Matthew 7, the people talked about the fact that he taught them as one who had authority, not as the scribes. So how did the scribes talk? They said, "Well, it's written, it's written." And what did Jesus say? He didn't say it's written. He might say you have read it or you have heard it, but I say. He would always finish that statement with what he said. And the officers who went to arrest him in John 7, they didn't. They said, "No man has ever spoke like this man," because he had the authority. And he didn't speak as if he was quoting something else. He spoke because he was the giver of the words, the giver of the law. What else did he speak? He claimed to be the only way to salvation. John 14:6, he said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father except through me." And in Acts 4:12, what did his apostles and his disciples say about him? "There is no salvation in any other, for there is no other name under heaven given among men by which we must be saved." Would a good teacher claim to be the only way of salvation if it weren't so? A good teacher wouldn't. Jesus is the only way to God. What else did he claim? He claimed to be the author and giver of life. John 5:21, he said, "The Son gives life to whom he will." John 6:48, he said, "I am the bread of life." John 11:25 and 26, he said, "I am the resurrection and the life." We already talked about John 14:6, about him being the way, the truth, and the life. In John 10:28, he says, "I give them eternal life, and they shall never perish, neither shall anyone snatch them out of my hand." If Jesus is a mere man, that is a big claim. He accepted worship. Now, what's interesting is during the temptation, what did he tell the devil when the devil said to worship me? He quoted Deuteronomy, and he said in Matthew 4, he said, "For it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God and him only." He said, only worship God. Yet what do we see throughout the New Testament? He accepted worship whenever it was given. The leper in Matthew 8, Jairus in Matthew 9, the man born blind in John 9:38, and Thomas in John 20. And what a statement of faith. What did Thomas say? He said, "My Lord and my God." And Jesus didn't correct him. He said, "By worshiping me, you're worshiping the Father." If he's just a man, that's a big claim. But because he accepted worship, how about his followers, the apostles, the founders of the church, that basement in the building that was being built? They surely should have accepted because they were around him all the time, right? No. Peter, when he was worshipped by Cornelius, he said, "Get up, I am just a man, do not worship me." Think about in Revelation when John is bowing down to the angels and starting to worship. The angels say, and they're a lot more powerful than we are, they said, "We are just servants. Worship God." So Jesus is the only one we read about who accepted worship. What else did he claim? He claimed to fulfill all the Old Testament prophecies. In Luke 24:44, he says, "These are the words I spoke to you while I was still with you, that all things must be fulfilled which are written in the law of Moses and the prophets and the Psalms concerning me." By hitting those three points, he covered the entire, what we call the Old Testament. He said, "Everything that points to the Messiah in all of this is pointing to me." In Matthew 5:18, he says, "Till heaven and earth pass away, not one jot or one tittle by my no means pass from the law till all is fulfilled." So what is a jot and what is a tittle? Well, I have pictures of them here. So a jot and a tittle. So a jot was the smallest letter in the Hebrew alphabet. And a tittle is just a little, you'd think it was, you know, people get fancy when they're doing calligraphy. It's just a little projection off of a letter to distinguish it between another one. Kind of like, is it the Braves or the Crimson Tide, one of them has that little extra swoop on it. It took me forever before somebody pointed that out, and I was like, oh, now I can't unsee it, which is very helpful. But they have little tittles so you can distinguish letters. And God's law is so specific, Jesus said, not even a little tiny mark is going to fail from the law until I fulfill it. And we're told he nailed the old law to the cross. You want to talk about, is there a lack of understanding or not? How specific did Jesus get in John 5? He says, "You search the scriptures, for in them you think you have eternal life. And these are they which testify of me, But you are not willing to come to me that you may have life. I do not receive honor from men, but I know you, that you do not have the love of God in you. For I have come in my Father's name, and you do not receive me. If another comes in his own name, him you will receive. How can you believe who receive honor from one another and do not seek the honor that comes from the only God? Do not think that I shall accuse you to the Father. There is one who accuses you, Moses, in whom you trust. For if you believed Moses, you would believe me, for he wrote about me. But you do not believe his writings. How will you believe my words? Is there any lack of understanding that he left about his claim for himself? If he was a mere man, that is a huge claim. But the biggest claim, people tell us he didn't claim to be God, but he sure did. He used God's intimate names that the Jews knew. In John 8:58, Jesus said to them, "Most assuredly I say to you, before Abraham was, I am." So not only is he using I am, the name of God, the eternal, the ever-existing, but he says, before Abraham lived, I was already there. And that's why we read that they sought to kill him, because he made himself equal with God. He said he was God. In John 18:4, it begins when he's being arrested. He says, "Who do you say that I am?" He says, "Who are you seeking?" They answered him, "Jesus of Nazareth." Now your text will probably have the word "he" in italics because it's not there in the original. Jesus said to them, "I am." It says they drew back and fell to the ground. I would love to know why they fell back. Did they see a glimpse of his power? Was it just the fact that hearing somebody actually say they were the eternal God, it just shocked them? We don't know. But he said, "I am God." And then he turned around and told Pilate, "My kingdom is not of this world." With all of these claims that he claimed for himself, what do we see in history? Well, there are six facts that there's no denying because Jesus lived. No matter if you believe in God or if you don't, you can look and say, well, I can't argue. There are six facts that happened. We know that Jesus was crucified, both in the Bible and secular history. We know the tomb was empty. Now, we might disagree about why it's empty, but people of other faiths will tell you, well, that's where Muhammad's buried and that's where Buddha's buried and y'all just have an empty tomb. And then they kind of realize what they said, because that's our claim, is he isn't buried there. He was. Another fact that you can't deny is that his disciples claimed and believed that he rose from the dead. Another one is that James, the skeptic, James's brother, was converted and believed that he rose from the dead. That Saul, the persecutor, was converted. And that in the midst of all of this, Christianity took off, all from potentially a man who made outlandish claims if he was just a man. So let's look at some of these facts. The fact that Jesus was crucified. This is really crucial. Some things, as you read the Gospels, you read in one Gospel but not the others. This one is in all four Gospels, and it takes up a big chunk of each of the books. It was very important. You look at John. John had some unique testimony because he says, "I was there, I saw it." And Mark might have seen it too, but John is the one who specifically says and later says, "I was there, I saw him." What about the Romans? No, they were experts at crucifixion. We know that Jesus was crucified well, if there is a well way of crucifying. The Persians had invented it, but the Romans perfected it. We read about during some of the slave uprisings when the Romans were dealing with it that they would crucify up to 30,000 people just lining the roads as warnings to other slaves, because there were millions of slaves throughout the kingdom. And so during one of the uprisings, 30,000 people were executed by crucifixion. We read about in Josephus during the destruction of Jerusalem that they crucified so many of the Jews trying to flee that they ran out of wood. And they were bringing wood from miles away, up to 10 miles away, to keep crucifying the Jews that were fleeing. We know that if the Romans crucified somebody, if they killed somebody and they said he was dead, you knew he was dead. We have external corroboration about that, and we looked at that as well. people who were unfriendly to Christianity, unfriendly to Jews, couldn't deny the fact that Jesus was crucified. Now, up until recently, people debated about crucifixion. They say, well, they wrote about it, but it really wasn't like that because there's no archaeological evidence. And especially if you crucified somebody as a criminal, they wouldn't have been buried in a nice tomb. And then along comes archaeological proof. This was the first one. And actually, they have reburied this heel bone. And so if you go to the museum, it's actually a replica that they have there. But when they were driving the nail through, it hit a knot in the wood and it bent. So they couldn't pull the nail out. Nails were valuable, so they'd reuse them. But this one they couldn't get out, and so the guy got buried in actually an ossuary. His family took him and gave him a decent burial. Since then, we've found two other evidences of crucifixion, one in Great Britain and one in Italy. But as you see this, do you think back to the promise to Eve in Genesis 3? She was told that your seed will bruise the serpent's head, and the serpent will bruise your seed's heel. We always read about that figuratively, but it was also literal. His heel was bruised because of a promise made in Genesis. One of my little rabbit tales is, what did Jesus say when he was on the cross? We read, he cried, he gave up the ghost, and he died. There's a Greek word, it's just one word, and it means it is finished. But in the Greek, it implies something has come to an end. It has been completed. It has been perfected. It's been accomplished in full. And the consequences of that will endure on and on. This is something that they would, I don't know if they had stamps, but you would stamp it on a mortgage. You would write it on the mortgage that the mortgage has been paid in full. You don't ever have to pay another penny on that. Athletes would cry this at the Olympics if they won. And in some ways it has both meaning. When Jesus died and that veil in the temple was torn in two, he both had won and paid the debt in full. For this next slide, I'm going to have to give you a lot of background. We talked about the tradition of the fathers, the oral law, the Talmud, the collection of all of that, the traditions that were passed down. And one of the traditions that was passed down was about the Day of Atonement. There were a number of things that would happen. You would cast lots for which was the scapegoat, which would be sacrificed, which would be sent off into the wilderness. And as you cast the lots, it was considered good luck for the lot to fall into your right hand. So they had an elaborate way of shaking to try to minimize bias. They would tie a scarlet ribbon around the scapegoat and let it go. And if it turned white, that would signify God had accepted the sacrifice. In the temple, when they would light the candles, they would light them from west to east. And so if the west one didn't go out first, that was a sign of God's glory, that he was there helping, the Shekinah glory. Because as you know, prior to the destruction of the temple, the Shekinah glory, the cloud, the fire, it was over the tabernacle, it was in the temple. But after the destruction of the Babylonians and the rebuilding of the temple, it was never recorded that the Shekinah glory ever was in the temple. We do know God was in the temple because Jesus went there. But their evidence of that, they never saw it. So these were substitutes that they would look for to say, okay, God is still with us. And after Nehemiah, there was a priest, Simon the Just, that apparently these things happened every year. He was so just and holy, the tradition says, these evidences happened every year. But it was intermittent after that. Now, what does the Talmud say about some of these things? So the rabbis taught 40 years before the temple was destroyed, which is about the time Jesus was crucified, was 40 years. So 40 years before the temple was destroyed, the lot never came into the right hand, the red wool did not become white, the western light did not burn, and the gates of the temple opened of themselves. Till the time that Rabbi Johanan Ben Zakkia rebuked them, saying, "Temple, temple, why alarmest thou us? We know that thou art destined to be destroyed, for of thee hath prophesied Zechariah ben Iddo, open thy doors, O Lebanon, and the fire shall eat thy cedars." So this is not the gospel. This is not the inspired word of God. But it is very interesting that the man who said he was the Son of God and the scapegoat for us all was crucified. And around the time of his death, all of the signs that they look for as God accepting their sacrifice ceased to exist. They never happened again. It's almost as if when God tore the temple, the veil of the temple from top to bottom, this was another way of him saying, it's changed. There's a new system now. I'm not going to be using the old system. You got to look to my Son. Now, what about the tombs? We were told it was a new tomb hewn out of the rock. They rolled a large stone over the tomb. We read about two angels sitting there, one at the head and one at the feet. What do tombs look like there? I mean, we're used to just headstone and people being buried. This was the most intact first century rolling stone tomb in Israel until some vandals came and the wall here, they pushed the stones over and destroyed it. But you can see the tomb cut into the rock. They had built a facade over it, and there's a rolling stone right here that they would have rolled. It could have looked like this. This is Herod's family's tomb. Same thing, you got a rolling stone, a doorway here that you would have gone into this complex. Now, if you go on the inside of one of these tombs and look out, and this is actually another one, Tomb of the Kings, you can see there's a big couple ton stone that would have rolled here. Now, for the people who say the swoon theory, Jesus passed out, woke up, and moved the stone, how would you have rolled a couple ton stone with your hands that have been pierced? How would you have rolled that? The woman even said, how are we going to do it? There's not enough of us to roll it. We read about the angels sitting there at the head. Well, they would have laid a body out. And you can see how an angel would have been sitting, one at his head and one at his feet. What do you do in the first century when you put somebody in a tomb? Well, you leave them there for a year because he's got to decompose. We read about with Lazarus, don't open the tomb. He's going to stink. He's already decomposing. Well, there were some tombs where you had multiple spots, and then there's a little doorway here that I'll show you in just a second. But you would have, if you had an elaborate enough tomb, you could have laid out a number of bodies. If you had a big enough family, sometimes it was just a single one. This one had a space for two. And in here, what do you have? Well, when you're done decomposing, in a year, they take your bones and they put them in there with everybody else. Why is that important to know it was a new tomb? Well, who got resurrected? Was it Grandpa? Was it Uncle Frank? Or was it Jesus? You don't know. A new tomb, there's only been one person in it. There's no denying who came out of that tomb. Well, the empty tomb. We know it was empty. How do we know it was? Well, we know about the burial story. Who buried him? It was two members of the Sanhedrin. The group that put him to death had some sympathizers of Jesus, and they're the ones who buried him. You can't deny where he was buried. It was a well-known tomb, a rich person. And then Paul makes some emphasis about that as well. So even in 1 Corinthians 15, where he talks about it, he's pointing out the fact that we know where he was buried. It was empty because they're in Jerusalem. If somebody had stolen the body, they'd say, oh, no, you're wrong. Here it is. We have the body. We stole it from you. Nobody could produce a body. And so we know the enemy of the Christians didn't steal it because they would have been just waiting for the opportunity to say he didn't rise from the dead. All the Gospels agree that Jesus arose. But even the enemies attest to it because they admit the tomb was empty. They had to make up this elaborate story. They say, well, his disciples, the scaredy cats who were hiding, came, overpowered the guards while they were, you know, or they were sleeping. and they stole the body. No matter how they did it, now they said they actually said the guards slept. For a guard to allow that to be said about him, he'd be put to death. Your job was to guard that body, and sleeping on duty was a criminal offense. Having somebody steal the body you were guarding is a criminal offense. Think about the Philippian jailer when he thought everybody had left the jail. He was going to kill himself because he knew he was going to be executed because prisoners had escaped. But the Jews had to make up a story, and they said, don't worry, you're not going to be in trouble. We'll pay him off, but just tell everybody his disciples came and stole it. Well, the guards leaving right there tells you it's an empty tomb because they are to guard the body. And if there's no body there, there's nothing to guard. They might as well go back. But they left the grave clothes, and they were folded. There was no stealing going on. Have you ever seen a house burglarized where they put everything back after they ransacked it? They vacuumed up, and they dusted. No. You get in and out as quick as you can. If you're stealing a body and there's guards sleeping, and you just moved this large stone, like, I hope he doesn't wake up, you're going to get out of there real quick. You're not going to fold the grave clothes. So there was no haste. But to me, the biggest thing is there's testimony of women. They said he rose. Why would that be such a big deal about women giving testimony about Jesus rising? What do we read about? Josephus says, but not let the testimony of women be admitted on the account of the levity and boldness of their sex, since it is probable that they will not speak truth either out of the hope of gain or the fear of punishment. The Talmud, this collection of Jewish teachings, says any evidence which a woman gives is not valid to offer. It is equivalent to saying that one who is rabbinically accounted a robber is qualified to give the same evidence as a woman. So in this time period, in this culture, you couldn't believe a woman, is what everybody said. Yet, they said, the woman said it first and we didn't believe them. Why would you admit that? Because everybody knows it's true. Everybody knows you didn't believe the women and they were the ones saying he rose. So for you to say anything different, they're going to know you're lying because they already know the story. And they use witnesses who would not be allowed to witness in a court of law because it was so. They said, well, technically she can't testify in court, but she said he rose and he did. That to me is a huge proof, just like an attestation of an enemy saying something nice about you is probably true. Well, what about this, the belief that Jesus rose from the dead? Well, we know it happened early. We know about Paul testifying about it. We know there was oral tradition. There was a lot of written tradition, both in the Gospels as well as all the church fathers, the early church fathers wrote about it. And we talked about corroboration and did they intend to tell the truth? Well, we read in the Gospels about they were skeptical. They did not believe that Jesus rose from the dead. But what do we see that proves he rose from the dead? They were hiding. And in 50 days, they went from being cowardly and running and hiding to courage and speaking out in front and being willing to be beaten. And eventually, to be martyred, to be killed for their faith. What about James, his brother? James, the brother of the Lord, initially, as we read, his brothers did not believe in him. But James, after seeing Jesus crucified, buried, and risen, he became a believer. He became active. He became a leader in the church in Jerusalem. And we read about his death as a martyr. He died because his half-brother, same mother Mary, that he didn't believe in, he realized he was the Son of God. He rose from the dead. And he went to his grave for him. What about Saul? He went to Damascus to persecute. He was a leading persecutor. But he had a personal encounter with Jesus. And that changed. And so what's really interesting about it is, you know, it's one thing to say, I believe in him and I saw Jesus. It's another thing to say, I didn't believe in him and I saw Jesus. That's a much different basis of evidence for me. You might lie and say, well, yeah, they're, you know, we're trying to make him into God, so I saw him. It's a much different thing to say, I didn't believe in him, I was persecuting, and I saw him and I changed. And Saul wasn't a believer, and he didn't have this precedent of having visions. This was the first one he ever had. It changed him. And as a Pharisee, he had a belief in a resurrection, but it was the general resurrection of everybody rising. He didn't have a belief in individual resurrection like this. And he definitely didn't have any motive, because he was a rising star. He was the Pharisee of Pharisees. He was going to be the next Gamaliel. And he turned his back on all of that because he had seen the risen Jesus. Speaking of Gamaliel, I really like him. I really hope that he obeyed and he became a Christian, because he's just a cool guy. It would be neat to talk to him one day. But in Acts 5, beginning in 35, what did he say? He said to them, "Men of Israel, take heed to yourselves what you intend to do regarding these men. For some time ago, Thaddeus rose up claiming to be somebody. He was slain, and all who obeyed him were scattered and came to nothing. After this man, Judas of Galilee drew away many people after him. He also perished, and all who obeyed him were dispersed." And then he says about the apostles. He says, "If this plan or if this work is of men, it will come to nothing. But if it is of God, you cannot overthrow it." And what happened? Well, we see the rise of Christianity. And was this just a man, or was this the Son of God? Because all of a sudden, Sunday became the day of worship. People who do history, whether you say AD and BC, or whether you do BCE or CE, what is the point that history flips? It's the life of Jesus. It's the birth of Jesus. His disciples had no resurrection theology. There was no precedence for this, but all of a sudden they're going around the world dying, saying Jesus rose. Given the views of crucifixion by both the Jews and the Greeks, it's impossible for anybody to say this was a heroic death. Somebody left on a tree, somebody crucified. This was accursed to the Jews and made no sense to the Greeks. So to be claiming this is your hero, this is your God, made no sense. And it was against everybody. You tell the Romans, well, you killed him. You tell the Jews, you killed him. The Jews killed their Messiah. That was what they'd been waiting for thousands of years. And for a Jew to say he is the Messiah and we killed him, that was a big deal. And for the Romans, not only did he die and rise, but he's the king, the only king. We have no king but Caesar, is what people would say. And the Christians say, no, Christ is the king. Christianity should not have risen when you look at that. It was against anything anybody believed or taught. Yet what do we see Christianity doing? Well, by the year 100, 64% of the port cities in the Mediterranean had churches in them. And by the year 80, 86% of them had churches in them. It kept growing and growing and growing. Well, we know Jesus lived. We know what he said. Why do I think what he said is so strong? I think C.S. Lewis summed it up really well. He said, "I'm trying here to prevent anyone saying the really foolish thing that people often say about him. I'm ready to accept Jesus as a great moral teacher, but I don't accept his claim to be God. That is the one thing we must not say. A man who is merely a man and said the sort of things Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic on the level of the man who says he is a poached egg, or else he would be the devil of hell. You must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman or something worse. You can shut him up for a fool, you can spit at him and kill him as a demon, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us not come with any patronizing nonsense about him being a great human teacher. He has not left that open to us. He did not intend to. And I think that sums it up very well. We look through history, and there are many men who wanted to be a god. But as we look through history, there's only one God who would be a man. And he came for us. I found this quote, and I find it very interesting that Christianity arose in such times. This author said, "Yet Jesus was apparently only a carpenter from an obscure village in a despised nation. He never studied in a university, nor any other school as far as we know. He never traveled more than a few miles from his home, never wrote a book or an article, never taught in a school. The only ones who paid much attention to what he taught, the multitudes sometimes listened and were impressed, but they soon forgot. But the only ones who paid much attention to what he taught were a motley band of unimpressive disciples, and even they missed the point on his most important teachings concerning his coming death and resurrection. Yet despite that, Christianity arose." And Henry Morris said that such an obscure itinerant teacher would leave a legacy of the greatest teachings that the world has ever known would seem absolutely impossible, but it is the fact. The only explanation that makes sense in all of that was that he was a teacher come from God, and that as he claimed, "Whatsoever I speak, therefore even as the Father said unto me, so I speak." I hope this series has been helpful for you. I do appreciate you all being here. I know some of you got sick, but you came back, so thank you. I appreciate you listening, but most importantly, I really hope this has pushed you to a lifetime of study, a lifetime of just digging deeper, diving into this. But I want you tonight, though, the last thought is just to think about the Creator of the universe. We talked about him speaking and everything leaping into existence. Said, "And he made the stars also, and we see billions and billions of them." But he cares enough about you and me, he started off showing it, that he just made us out of the dirt and breathed life into us. We sinned and we left him, and he sent his son, his only son. I can't imagine giving up my son. And I got two of them. I got a spare one. I can't imagine giving either of them up. But God did that for us. And we can look around at the world around us. We can look at evidences, and we know that the book he left us is true. All you have to do is read it, and it's simple what he's told us to do. He wants us to follow him. He wants us to be his children. If you have a need to be his child tonight, please come forward as we stand and sing.